Good afternoon, brethren. Well, it's nice to see and hear you all. Thank you for the warm welcome we've received so far. Bring your greetings from Cincinnati, so far away. It's almost like it's in another state. We were up here this past week with some family members at the museum just down the road, so it's nice to be back again. We didn't realize we'd be back so quickly, but are thankful for the opportunity to be here. Do you remember the ad campaign on television in the last couple of years? There were two characters in it primarily. One was thinner, younger, hipper, cooler looking. The other was older, decidedly nerdier, slightly latitudinal in shape, round. And it would start off with, "I am a Mac and I am a PC." Do you remember that campaign? There were some really funny commercials done in that. The younger hip character was supposed to personify a Mac and to extol the benefits of that particular computer and operating system. The other, seemingly more fuddy-duddy of the two, was supposed to be a PC. Slower, good at some things, just not very many cool or fun things. And I'm not sure how many different commercials they had, but they went back and forth. They entertained us probably for close to a year until finally that campaign graduated to other things. And in their fashion, Microsoft had an answer about a year later. "I'm a PC." Do you remember seeing those? Countering the nerdy guy. There are cool people that can use PCs. Well, I am from the IT department, but this will not be about computers. You look relieved. It's not about computers, but about what they were talking about in that commercial. They weren't saying, "I use a Mac or I use a PC," but, "I am a Mac and I am a PC. What I use is what I am. What I am becomes what I'm like, who I am." Now, the book of John has a number of "I am" statements that Christ himself spoke, seven. And so in the time remaining, what I'd like to do is to go through with you those seven "I am" statements. So you can start turning to the book of John. We'll start in John chapter 6. John chapter 6, we'll read verses 32 through 35. So at the beginning of the chapter, Christ feeds the 5,000. They're grateful for the miracle that they have seen, how some loaves and fishes could be extended far better than I've seen some grandmas able to extend their foodstuffs. I've seen my grandma extend food quite well, but it was nothing like this miracle where he was able to feed 5,000, which what would have required two-thirds of a year's wage. So the crowd eats. The next day they disappear. Christ and the disciples go across the sea. They follow them. They find him, and they're speaking with him. They want to learn more about this way of life, about what he has to teach. Verse 32, "Then Jesus said to them, 'Most assuredly, I say to you, Moses did not give you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives his life to the world.' Then they said to him, 'Lord, give us this bread always.'" They said, "This sounds good. We'll have some. We'll take an order." Verse 35, "And Jesus said to them, 'I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst.'" Bread back in that time frame was more than it is today. Bread is something that we toast, maybe for breakfast, once in a while, maybe every breakfast. Bread can be used to make toad in the hole. Ever had toad in the hole? It doesn't sound good, does it? No, you take a slice of bread, you get a glass, invert the glass, cut a hole in the piece of bread, put that on the skillet, crack an egg, fill the hole. That's really easy to flip that way. Bread then was far more significant than it is now. Not due entirely to the Atkins diet, but because bread was an extender. Bread was something that would go with every meal, not breakfast only, not lunch, breakfast, lunch, dinner. It could be used as utensils even. Have you been to some Middle Eastern restaurants and the dishes arrive and there's no utensil. You're expected to dip with your bread. That is how you dish it out. So bread was not an optional part of food in those days. He used that analogy on purpose because bread was the meal. And the others were the condiments. It reminds me a little bit. I'll get back to what it reminds me of. Let's take a look at Revelation 7. Revelation chapter 7, we'll read verses 13 through 16. Revelation 7. 13 through 16. So chapter 7, we're reading what John was told, who the sealed were of the different tribes of Israel, 12,000 in each. And after that, they see he is shown a great multitude of all nations, tribes, and people, and tongue. And verse 13, then one of the elders answered, saying to me, who are these arrayed in white robes, and where did they come from? And I said to him, I have no idea. He said, you know, sir. Sir, you know. And he said to me, these are the ones who come out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are ever before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will dwell among them. They shall neither hunger any more nor thirst any more. Why? Because they have the bread of life, finally. Back to what I was reminded of. Thanks for reminding me. I heard a comedian one time talking about different culinary cultures, different foods from different lands. And the food that he was talking about, one of my favorite. I enjoy Mexican food, or at least what they serve in Mexican food restaurants here. I love it. It's great stuff. Now, this comedian discovered a formula that may not have been obvious to everybody. Maybe it was to you, but it wasn't to me. And he described, if you were to explain to somebody who had never tasted Mexican food before or tried it, how would you describe it? Well, you could tell them the name of it. You could say, have you had a taco? No, I don't know what a taco is. Well, a taco, you see, is a tortilla, and it has meat and cheese with it. Oh, okay, that sounds interesting. What else is there? Well, there's an enchilada. And how is an enchilada made? Well, it's a tortilla with meat and cheese. Okay, sounds good. Is there anything else? Well, there's taquitos. And what are taquitos? Taquitos are very different. They're a tortilla with meat and cheese. Tostados. Oh, they're good too. Very much unlike the other ones. It's a tortilla with meat and cheese. Burritos, tortilla with meat and cheese. Chimichangas, well, that's different yet because it's a tortilla with meat and cheese. The tortilla in this case is the bread of that culture. And so if you have ever had Mexican food and had anything with tortillas, that is more what he's talking about. Not our slice of bread on the side of the plate. This was an integral part of their meal. Anything they ingested had bread in it. And that's what Christ is talking about, as a central part of sustaining. We eat to sustain our lives, and that is what Christ is talking about. I am the bread of life. The second one, in John chapter 8, verse 12, I'm the light of the world. I am the light of the world. John 8, verse 12. And again Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. I had the opportunity of going to Merrimack Cave as a youngster on our way to probably Lake of the Ozarks. Has anybody here stopped in that cave, that particular cavern? Merrimack? Any other cavern visitors other than Merrimack? Okay, how many have heard of caves? Okay. All right, now we know what we're talking about. At the time, I don't believe they do this anymore, they would lead you back into the cavern, back past these beautiful formations, the lights would shine off of the sparklies that would hang down from the ceiling. And eventually you'd wind your way back, and the guard, or the guide rather, would stop, ask you to take a deep breath, and then turn off the lights. Have you had that happen to you? Yes. And it's dark. The darkness you can feel. And then they turn on, finally, a light source. Some would light a match, for example, and see how much light would be cast from just that one little match. I heard Mr. Holliday talking about this one time in a sermon, explaining secondary light sources. For anybody who goes caving, they get lost, their lights burn out. What can you use? Well, you can use all kinds of things to produce light. Say, the backlight on a cell phone can produce light. Now, if you're outside in the midday and trying to check email, it is very difficult to do so in that light. But at nighttime, if someone were to turn on their cell phone while someone else is sleeping, you can almost hear that light. It is so bright compared to that darkness. Jesus said, I am the light of the world, illuminating the world. Let's take a look at Isaiah chapter 8. Isaiah chapter 8, we'll start in verse 22. Isaiah is talking about a prophecy here about Assyria invading the country because they have slidden away. They have abandoned God's laws. Isaiah 8:22. I guess we'll start in 21. They will pass through the land greatly distressed and hungry. When they are hungry, they will be enraged and will curse their king and their gods. They will turn their faces upward, where they will look to the earth. But they will see only distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be thrust into thick darkness. Chapter 9, but there will be no gloom for those who were in anguish. In the former time he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the latter time he will make glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. Verse 2, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in a land of deep darkness, on them light has shined. Can you hear Handel's Messiah, one of the arias, talking about this great light? Not too long ago, there was a theft in our neighborhood. One of the gas cans was not just emptied, the whole gas can was taken. And so the neighbor installed a new yard light. And I don't know where he bought this light, but that light produces enough energy, or at least enough lumens, that we can almost walk around in the living room with the lights off, curtains closed, and I can avoid the Lego traps on the floor. So this individual wittingly or unwittingly installed light for security so that we could shine and expose bad deeds committed by gasoline thieves. Is it really that expensive? I know it takes a hit, but really? A gas can? Anyway. The purpose was to illuminate his yard. It turns out it illuminates far more than his yard. It illuminates my living room. But Christ talks about being a light, not just a light to a nation, not just a light to the Middle East, not a light to a particular hemisphere, but he's a light to the whole world. That is where he will extend light to the world. I am the light of the world. The third I am the door of the sheep. I am the door of the sheep. John 10. John chapter 10. We'll read verses 1 through 10. What time does Mr. McCready like to end around? This isn't a trap door, is it? Okay. John chapter 10. Most assuredly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hears his voice. And he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And when he brings them out, his own sheep, he goes before them. And the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. Yet they will by no means follow a stranger, but flee from him, for they do not know the voice of strangers. My grandfather, when he was still ranching, had, oh, I don't know how many head of cattle, maybe 100 head, pulled Herefords. And I would enjoy going to the family farm in Missouri and helping, as grandsons do, who are city slickers, by watching from the truck. But I enjoyed the spectacle, the lack of concrete. I think that's what I enjoyed most. But he would drive his truck down. He wanted to get a count who was here. And he would call them. And I can't remember exactly what he would say when he would call them, but at the time I was fairly good at mimicking him. And he would call, and boy, they would come running. And we would go back again, and I would call, trying his, whatever he said, the way he said it, they wouldn't come to me. There was something about the way I was short, maybe. They didn't know my voice. They sure knew his voice, though. Maybe it was the fact that I wasn't driving the truck, but was riding a bicycle. Whatever the case was, they knew his voice. Jesus used this illustration, but they did not understand the things which he spoke to them. Then Jesus said to them again, "Most assuredly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. I am the door of the sheep." Let's take a look at Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2, 17 through 18. I'll pick up verse 13. "But now in Christ Jesus, you who once were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ." Verse 17. "And he came and preached peace to you who were far off and to those who were near. For through him we both have access by one Spirit to the Father." Through him, the door of the sheep. Now, commentaries will point out the door of the sheep. There'd be an enclosure where the sheep would be kept at night so they could be safe. And there was no door. It was an exterior constructed location. They were, after all, shepherds. They weren't carpenters. And their job was to take care of the sheep, not necessarily to build fancy gates. So rather than use a gate, it was the shepherd's job to lay in that threshold. That was where the shepherd would sleep. They would lie down in that doorway. So the critters on the outside, who were less than friendly to the critters on the inside, could not get in without the shepherd knowing. Similarly, the sheep on the inside could not mistakenly stray out. Even though they could hear those coyotes singing wonderful ballads to them, "Please come out and visit with us." That's the thing about doors, isn't it? It's a two-way process. Keeps things out and keeps things in. And it's so easy for sheep to see the shepherd maybe as an obstacle to great fun on the outside, but it's for their safety. So that was where the shepherd were to lie, to become the actual door. We have a member family in the Toronto, Ontario congregation who build doors. That's what they do for a living now, or at least part of their living. They build doors, fancy doors. Doors for very upscale houses or hard-to-fit doors of unusual dimensions and sizes. And they've made quite an art and science out of that particular business. But not all doors are equal, are they? In your own home, you have an exterior door and you have an interior door. And they're made of different materials. Does your exterior door swing a little heavy? Does it have mass to it? It should be heavier than the door on the inside because it has a different purpose. It's probably metal. It may have a solid core. It could have a hollow core. But the doors inside generally are made of wood. Some of them are made of plywood. Some might even be made of glorified paper or cardboard. Do not use that one for an exterior door. It will not work out so well in our arid Ohio summers, will it? There are good doors and bad doors. Imagine your dream home. Anybody been to the Homeramas around here? There are some exquisite houses built, palaces. I'm not sure I could afford the front door. But looking at those homes, in order to protect what is inside, there has to be a door. Imagine a dream home given to you or me. What would it look like? How many roofs would it have? Windows? Would there be a pool? Would there be an exterior barbecue? What kind of home would it look like? And what kind of home would it be if it didn't come with a door? It would not be very secure, would it? It wouldn't feel secure. When Christ says, "I am the door of the sheep," he's there to protect his sheep. The fourth, "I am the good shepherd." I am the good shepherd. Let's turn to John 10. I should have warned you to bookmark it, sorry. Back to John 10. So we just finished expressing that he is the door of the sheep. The thief does not come except to steal in verse 10 and to kill and to destroy. I have come that they may have life, that they may have it in abundance. In verse 11, I am the good shepherd. The shepherd gives his life for the sheep. But a hireling who is not the shepherd, one who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves and flees. And then the wolf has a snack. He is the good shepherd, and he tells what he would do, what he was willing to do for his sheep. Let's take a look at 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel 17. We'll read verse 33 through 35. So here Israel is fighting with the Philistines. They've been at an impasse in the valley for quite a while because they have an unusual request. Goliath comes out and hurls taunts at Israel's army. Let's make this easy, he says. I'll fight one of you, and you can fight me. The champions of each army, and whoever wins will be servants. And we know from this passage that the Philistines were good for their word. Or were they? When Goliath fell, they did not serve Israel at all, did they? So David comes along to deliver victuals to his brothers, and he hears the taunts and decides something has to be done. He volunteers to fight. And Saul wants to make sure he's the right person for the job. After all, he doesn't look like the right person for the job. So he asks him some questions. Verse 33, and Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you're but a youth. He is a man of war from his youth." And David said to Saul, "Your servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock, and I went after it and struck it and delivered the lamb out of its mouth. And when it rose against me, I caught it by the beard and struck it and killed it." I would love to have David as my friend and not as my opponent. Here David was watching his sheep. He's watching his father's sheep. And he took it upon himself to rescue a group, a ewe who was really productive. No, a lamb. It could have been replaced later, next spring. But he didn't see it that way. David did not see this lamb as being expendable or disposable, but he went after it risking his own life to bring it back. No wonder he is referred to as a man after God's own heart. What did the good shepherd do but sacrifice his life for all mankind, those who are all potentially his sheep? He led by example, didn't he? It just goes to show you there are good shepherds, there are bad shepherds, and ugly shepherds. He's the good shepherd. Do you remember the story of the cruise ship Costa Concordia? In the last couple of years, it was an Italian cruise liner, and it was taking passengers into port. The captain got a little too close to shore, scraped a reef, punctured the hull, and the ship sank slowly over the course of an hour. People didn't know what to do. They came out of their cabin. Should we launch the lifeboats? Well, maybe, but the crew said, we don't really know how to launch the lifeboats. Eventually, the captain decided, you know, this is disorganized enough. I think I'll leave. And he fled, Captain Scatino, who is now facing charges for that incident. I believe there were over 30 people that died in that fiasco. A good captain is supposed to go down with the ship. I don't think Signore Scatino will earn that title as being a good captain. But we see from Scripture that Christ is the good shepherd. He said, I am the good shepherd. He will take care of his sheep, even sacrificing his life for them. The fifth, I am the resurrection and the life. I am the resurrection and the life. Let's look at John 11. John 11, we'll read verses 23 through 26. John 11. Christ was traveling. Lazarus gets sick. He's alerted of it. Lazarus is sick, come quick. And he waits 2 extra days. He doesn't go home right away, does he? He waits an extra 2 days before returning home. We'll start in verse 20. Now Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him, but Mary was sitting in the house. Now Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. She knew what kind of authority he had. Maybe she needed a little extra education as to the extent of his authority. Verse 22, but even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. So she had a pretty good grasp. Verse 23, Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, you mean he's not in heaven already? No, that's not what it says. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Verse 25, Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. I am the resurrection and the life. I had the opportunity this past late spring, early summer, of going back to the family farm. My uncle learned, about a week before we went, that he had terminal lung cancer and had just a couple months left to live. So thankfully, with some flexibility and schedule, we were able to make a trip, and I was able to go and visit with him and my grandparents. And it was good to visit, good to say hello, good to say goodbye. It was difficult, though, to see him in the shape he was in. He'd been ailing for quite a while. His lungs had not been working very well. He thought he had pneumonia. So all winter long, he was just kind of limping along. Energy level was low. He couldn't breathe. So I suppose that would be why your energy level would be low. Didn't have much of an appetite. And so to go back and see him tethered to his oxygen machine was a big contrast to what we had been used to seeing out of him. He was an avid outdoorsman, loved to go fishing, try to tangle with a bass. He enjoyed that on a good summer night. He enjoyed being out in the field where he grew up, occasionally hunting for deer or turkey. And when we would go over to visit, he would be up for just maybe an hour at a time and then have to go lie down again. So there he was at the table sitting, kind of stooped, and there were the binoculars up on the shelf. Now, any other evening, he would have been attached to those binoculars, looking outside to see where the turkeys were, where the deer were. And that tackle box was in the corner, the fishing rod was in the corner, unused because he couldn't. He was attached to his oxygen machine, and even if he had the will to do so, he just didn't have the strength to do so anymore. I can remember going various summers to haul hay. I still love the smell of cut hay. It smells great and feels terrible. I don't like the feel of freshly cut hay on my arms. But it was fun working in the field with them. The whole family would get together, the aunts, the cousins, even Grandpa. He would have been in his late 70s at the time. He finally was convinced that he should be in the truck driving, not in the back hauling hay and throwing hay. But I wanted to be there too. I liked the farm, and so the city slicker kid would come where the cousins were, and the cousins would be throwing up hay. I'd have to use two hands and muscle it up there as best I could, slower than the girls even. But then here comes my uncle, and he's carrying a bale in each hand. And you can tell he's done it before because he doesn't struggle. He just pitches it casually, has just the right arc, the right depth, just the right spin so that it lands almost perfectly. The person up top who was stacking was nearly redundant because he had done it so many times. His wrists were, you know, he's a farm boy. He could do these things. But not this summer. He was just a shadow of what he was. And you could say that based on his condition, he was existing. He wasn't really living. He was existing. But Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life." A week and a half, 2 weeks after I left from visiting, my uncle finally succumbed. And so now the family is very aware of the resurrection and the life. Let's take a look at Romans 5. Romans chapter 5. We'll read 19 through 21. So here we're looking at a contrast between Adam and Christ, the contrast between two tangents or two vectors of life. "But as by one man's disobedience many were made sinners, so by the obedience of one," capital O, "shall many be made righteous. But the law entered, so that the offense might abound. But where sin abounded, grace did much more abound." Verse 21, "So that as sin is reigned to death, even so grace might reign through righteousness to eternal life by Jesus Christ our Lord." We're born, we grow, we strengthen, we weaken, and we know what happens in the long run. As John Maynard Keynes, I can't say I agree with all of his economic theories, but he had this right. Economists are trying to think in long terms, or they should be thinking in long terms if they are not engaged in political economics. He said, "In the long run, we're all dead." He got that right, didn't he? We see that with our gardening, we see that with our homes, the tree in our backyard you used to swing on. It's only temporary. But that's not the end of the story, is it? Because of what Christ said, "I am the resurrection and the life." Not another temporary life, but an eternal life. The sixth "I am" John 14. I am the way, the truth, and the life. John 14. I'm pretty sure I have one of those too. 13, 14. Yes, here we are. John 14, let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions or rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Is it just me, or can you hear a song right now? And where I go, you know, and the way you know. And Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you're going, and how can we know the way? Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. I had the opportunity of watching a program. Let's see, was it Discovery? Was it TLC? I don't know. It was one of the networks we don't get but can see at the library. We got the DVDs and watched them. How the States Got Their Shapes. Anybody see that? Some of you have. Very interesting. And the guy was pretty entertaining, too. How the States Got Their Shapes. What influenced the odd panhandles? Why does Oklahoma have that little squirt off to the west? Why is it that, is it Delaware that has the curve at the top? It's not flat, it's curved. And why is it that Ohio's northwest border is not straight, but actually goes upwards into Michigander territory? Why did Ohio get Toledo? And so the gentleman goes through and talks about all of the forces, all of the nuances in history that influence the shape of each state. It was great for a map nerd like me. I loved it. If you don't like maps, try one episode. You might learn to like it. And if you don't, blame someone else. But in this particular series, I think it was just a one-year series, they talked about not only the state shapes, but also about the northern border with Canada. That really got my attention, being a Julie, a Canadian and American citizen. There is a town that straddles the U.S.-Canada border. Specifically, it's New York and Quebec. Now, not everybody in Quebec thinks they're part of Canada, but on the map, they are part of Canada. Trust me. So this town grew up far away from the houses of politics of Ottawa, Canada, and of Washington, D.C. They went about their business of creating lives, not worried about some political party, about borders that didn't mean so much out in that part of the boondocks. So they built a town, only to find out that the border ran right through it. So one side of town is in Canada, in the province of Quebec. The other side of town is in the United States, in the state of New York. And there's a street, like any town, that runs perpendicular, a series of streets running perpendicular through the town. Now, up until 2002, the border was recognized, but the border was not enforced. So there were relatives that would live on either side of the border and could meet up. They could walk across this street, go to Aunt Mabel's house for tea, and she could come across the street and have dessert at Grandma Smith's house. And they were in separate countries. They were citizens of different nations. But the border went right through it. In fact, there is a library in this town. You go into the library and you'd see, just like you would expect in any library, books. You see a flag and another flag. on either side of a strip of, it wasn't duct tape, I think it was masking tape, I think it was white, that runs showing the border through the middle of this building. So you can walk in one door of the library from the U.S. side. You can check with circulation, find out where your book is, go into Canada, get your book, and take it home. Similarly, someone from the Canadian side can enter in, get a book from the American side, and leave. The rule is you cannot leave through a different door. Some have tried, apparently. They got to know some of the customs agents a little more closely. So now relatives cannot go across the street to meet with their family. If they want to go across the border, they now have to drive something like an hour to the border crossing, through the checkpoint, go just to be across the street. So they used to take a newspaper and deliver it to whoever it belongs to. Not anymore. There is a barrier now to prevent that. So if you wanted to get to your relative's house, you can't go across the street. You cannot go through the library. You can't get there from here. This is not the way. You have to go through the proper channels now in order to cross the border. Let's take a look at Acts chapter 4. Acts chapter 4. How the states got their shapes. Check it out. It's a very good counter-argument from a historical perspective as to how this country was founded on religious principles, not on secularism. Acts 4, verse 12, "And there is salvation in no other one, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved." Jesus said quite plainly, quite clearly, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." The seventh I am the true vine. I am the true vine. That will take us to John 15. I should have told you to bookmark it again. I'm sorry. John 15, verses 1 through 5. "I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine grower. He removes every branch in me that bears no fruit. Every branch that bears fruit he prunes to make it bear more fruit. You have already been cleansed by the word that I have spoken to you. Abide in me as I abide in you. Just as the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides or is joined to the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine. You are the branches. Those who abide in me and I in them bear much fruit, because apart from me you can do nothing. I am the true vine." Anybody have grapes growing at home? Anybody want to grow grapes? Anybody know what a grape is? Okay. Now we're getting somewhere. A vine is not a plant that a nomad would typically carry with them. It would have maybe goats, something that is portable, something that is easily grown, but a vine isn't among them. A vine is something that requires how long? If you plant a sprig, how long does it take to bear fruit? How many years? Several? Three? Maybe four? It's an investment, isn't it, of time. And it requires a good location. It's not a good idea to plant them under a canopy of trees. It's not a good idea to plant them in the middle of the desert. There are parts of this country that are known to be wine country because they have just the right blend of acidity in the soil, the right nutrients, the right growing conditions, including jet stream and air temperature, humidity. It has to be just right to get a good crop of grapes. And then the vines have to be tended. A vine is not something that is just flippantly planted, not if you want good results. was reminded of a friend of ours from the neighborhood, from school. He comes over and plays with the kids, and he saw our backyard with plants growing edible things, and that really caught his attention. I really identified with him. Plants that look pretty and grow food. He's got a sharp eye. And so he looked at the plants and said, "Mr. Wazelkoff, yes, can you give me one of your peach seeds so I could grow a peach tree?" I said, "Sure, I can save you some seeds. Yeah, not a problem. Later this summer when they're ripe, I'll save one for you. We can dry it, maybe put it in the freezer, and then you can plant it." And his face kind of clouded a little bit. He was excited when I said sure right off the bat, and he was a little disappointed. Why? So I just kind of asked, "What's the matter?" "Well, how long does it take for a seed to make peaches on the tree?" So, "Well, that's going to be 3 or 4 years before that happens." "You got anything else?" I said, "Okay, well, let's look around." And so we toured around the yard and the garden. He picked out, "Oh, what's that? Are those strawberries?" "Yeah, those are strawberries. And they've got flowers on them. And better yet, there were a few plants that actually had fruit starting to grow on them. Can I have one of those?" "What, a strawberry?" "No, the plant." "All right." So we dug up a few plants for him. He took them home and has put them in his own little garden. He's tending them and very excited to tell us that they're producing fruit. And not only are they producing fruit, but they're also sending out the runners to make new plants. And so not only can he have fruit in the first year, he can have new plants in the first year. Now that's exciting. So then we talked about the blackberries. "Mr. Wazelkoff?" "Yes, Thatcher." "How long does it take before a blackberry makes fruit?" I said, "Well, these green ones that are growing up out of the ground with the flimsy little thorns, we could dig that up for you, and then next summer you should be able to get some fruit off of them." He stuck with the strawberries. Yeah. Vines take a while. A grapevine takes time. It takes patience. Now, I don't know about you, but I sure am glad that God is patient with me to trim me just the right way, that attached to the vine, this branch can do something. A couple years back, we had a plum tree. No, a couple years before the plum tree, I planted an apple tree. I think it may have been a Mother's Day gift. An apple tree. And it was doing pretty well. It was growing. It seemed to be sending out new branches. And then it started to get a rust on the leaves and decided to be unhappy. And I believe it was the next year it was kindling. It was dead. But the rust that came with the apple tree got on to the peach tree and got on to the plum tree. And it wreaked havoc with my plums. I had this beautiful looking plum tree. The plums were coming out, and then they would just kind of turn black and shrivel and fall to the ground. So I did research and traced it back probably to the apple tree. And it was disheartening to see year after year, how am I going to get rid of this ick, whatever it was? We sprinkled ash on the ground and raked really well. And finally, this year, we have a good crop of plums. They're delicious. We think so, and so do the worms. But I'm glad I was patient with that tree. I came this close to cutting it down, because I just couldn't stand watching the fruit get ready and there they go again. I just couldn't take that anymore. I was going to make room for at least something else that could grow. How thankful we can be that God is patient with us to prune us in just the right way, as we see in this passage. Let's take a look at Psalm 80. Psalm 80. Psalm 80, the heading in my Bible says, "Prayer for Israel's Restoration." Is that what it says in yours too? Psalm 80, verse 8. You have brought a vine out of Egypt. You have cast out the nations and planted it. You cleared before it and caused it to take deep root. If it doesn't have a deep root in the heat, it doesn't do so well, does it? And it, the vine, filled the land. The hills were covered with its shadow, and its boughs were as the great cedars. It was strong. It was vigorous in its growth. It sent out its boughs to the sea and its branches to the river. They expanded. Why have you broken down its hedges so that all who pass by the way pluck it? Verse 13, the boar out of the wood wasted, and the wild beast of the field eats it. That reminds me, I do need to put a net on my grapes. They are starting to get big, and before long, I know it, those robins and other birds will start tasting it before I can. Verse 14, return, we beg you, O God of hosts, look down from heaven and behold and visit this vine and the vineyard which your right hand has planted and the son that you make strong for yourself. It is burned with fire and cut down. They perish at the rebuke of your holy face. Let your hand be on the man of your right hand, on the son of man whom you have made strong for yourself, so we will not go back from you. Make us live, and we will call on your name. Turn us again, O Jehovah, or Lord, the God of hosts. Cause your face to shine, and we will be saved. Summary of Israel. God selected just the right place for them, planted them, and then they turned from him. So he broke down the hedge. They were overrun. Thankfully, that's not the end of the story. Thankfully, there will be a replanting. So that is the seventh I am. What did that hearken to? Was that familiar to the audience? It certainly was to the Jews. Let's take a look at the Pharisees. What they said, John 8. John chapter 8. Towards the end of the chapter, 58. So here they're Pharisees and Jesus are going back and forth trying to establish Christ's authority. They understood his authority but refused to accept it, trying to rely on some loopholes to get out of yielding to him. John 8:58-56. They claim lineage through Abraham, which was correct. And Christ said, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day. And he saw it and was glad. Then the Jews said to him, you are not yet 50 years old. And have you seen Abraham? Verse 58, Jesus said to them, most assuredly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. Then they took up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself, went out of the temple, going through the midst of them, and so passed by. So verse 58, before Abraham was apparently, according to Greek scholars, I say according to Greek scholars because I'm not. If we go by what they say, before Abraham was implies before Abraham was created. It's not just talking about a past tense, but talking about how he came into being. Abraham was created in the past. Before Abraham was, I am. I am. That is not created. That is expressing his divinity. I can remember when I was younger, say in my late teens, in the congregations where Dad pastored, I would look at the young families. They would be late 20s maybe with kids, and I would see them with tired looks on their faces. They didn't want to stay out late. They seemed to be dragging. And I don't know that this was a conscious thought, but as I look back upon that time, I think what was going through my mind is, I'm glad I'll never be like that, because there must be some poor life choices that they have selected to become older and tired and stressed out I want to make that mistake. Surprise. No. There is a point in our lives where we can say, I am. Not with the capital A. The proof is in any cemetery with that hyphen between the two dates. We can say, I am, for a while. And then at some point, somebody will say, he or she was. But not so with Christ. He said, I am. I always existed. Self-sufficiency is also implied in I am. One of the great lessons of fasting. How self-sufficient are we? When we go without food or water for 24 hours, by the end of that we feel at best unenergetic, sometimes with a throbbing headache. Not terribly self-sufficient, are we? We can do our best to take care of our needs, but we're not self-sufficient. We're certainly not self-sustaining like God and Jesus Christ, who can say, I am. And what was their reaction? Verse 59. Then they, the Pharisees, took up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple, going through the midst of them. They understood what that meant. They recognized where that came from. Let's take a look in Exodus. It's no accident he used I ams, and it's no accident he used before Abraham was I am. This goes back to Moses' calling. Exodus chapter 3. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, and I bet he was a good shepherd. His father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Verse 2. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of the bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Moses apparently had some curiosity, or at least he was observant, and saw something's amiss here. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside to see of this great sight why the bush does not burn. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called him, or called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. What's not included here was whether or not his voice cracked. Verse 5, then he said, do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Verse 7, and the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. For I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up from the land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey. Sounds sticky. To the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites and the Stalactites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Verse 11, but Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? So he said, I will certainly be with you, and this shall be a sign to you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Verse 13, then Moses said to God, indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to join you, or sent me to you, and they say to me, what is his name? What's the secret password? What is his name? By what authority? Moses asked, what shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am, has sent me to you. So he uttered it again. He said it to Moses. He said it to the Pharisees, but he also expressed part of who he was, what he was capable of, in seven I am statements here in the book of John. Because I work with computers, maybe, perhaps it's just because I'm a nerd, I enjoy technology commercials, even if I don't have the product. But I'm sure you've heard the expression, there's an app for that. Have you seen that commercial? There's an app for that. It's a doctor wanting to keep track of patient files. What am I going to do? There's an app for that. I'm a jogger, and I need to know how many calories I've burned. I need to keep track of my time, my pace. There's an app for that. They're selling you the device and encouraging you to buy more stuff for that device with those different applications. So now those devices are everywhere. There's probably a few in this room. There's an app for that, to make your lives more convenient, to make it more fulfilling. Well, there are times, brethren, that we go through challenges in our life, through rough spots, through challenges of health, challenges of finance, challenges of relationships, all kinds of challenges that are trying, that are grueling, that test the depth of our roots, that test how well we are connected to the vine. Well, when those times occur, it's important to look back in Scripture to realize, in this case, there's an I am for that. When a loved one passes away, there's an I am for that. I am the resurrection. The way, the truth, the life. There's something better coming, as was alluded to in the sermonette, in the model prayer. We have hope. So this whole world needs to know these things, needs to have Christ in their lives. Our job is to preach it to them and tell them there's an I am for that. There is a way you can participate in it. So, brethren, let's keep that to heart when we do face those challenging times when the winds are blowing. There's an I am for that.